Hola, Sue. This afternoon we return to the meditative cultivation of empathetic joy. So there are so many different ways of approaching this practice. It's good to give it some variety, some freshness each time. Not let it become too formulaic. As I was reflecting on it today, it occurred to me that one approach here, again, beginning self-reflectively and then extending outwards, as we've done so often for the others of the four immeasurables, is to reflect back not only on the kindness that others have shown us from infancy onwards up into the present moment, not only reflect upon the goodness, the virtues, the excellent qualities we brought to life over the years and decades of our lives, but also to reflect upon, to take delight in the good fortune that's come our way, which isn't so pinpointed on one person or one act, but more context, opportunity, situation. And in fact, that type of meditation is really one of the very first ones in multiple schools, pretty much all schools of Tibetan Buddhism, in the Gelugpa school, where Noach was trained for many, many years, in the Lam Rim, as many of you will know, that the first discursive meditation that you really apply yourself to is reflecting on the preciousness and rarity of a fully endowed human rebirth. And that is to say, a human existence in which all of the outer and inner circumstances have come together, 18 of them, such that the mosaic is complete, and if you wish to set out on a path to enlightenment, there's nothing to stop you. It's kind of like just suddenly being on the freeway and say, hey, there's no traffic in front of me. It's just wide open. There it is. There's enlightenment. Here I am. And there's just a freeway in between me and it. There it is. So what's preventing me? And so to reflect upon that, to reflect upon one's own opportunities, the same theme comes up in the Kagyu Nyingma tradition, the Sakyu tradition. It's the same in the Kagyu Nyingma traditions very, very frequently. Oh, my teacher, Gyatso Rinpoche, he could not have more emphasized the importance of focusing on what are variously translated as the four thoughts that turn the mind, and the first is the same theme of really attending to and recognizing what kind of a situation am I in right now? How have I gotten here, and what are my opportunities? And it really does shift the mind. It is so easy to take our circumstances for granted and thereby not take advantage of them. So all sentient beings are seeking for happiness. There's no question about that, wishing to be free of suffering. In the meantime, very few of us on very few occasions really recognize what are the true causes of suffering, because the finger is always pointing outwards. And very few of us recognize what are the true causes of happiness, because the finger is always pointing outwards. He makes me happy, she makes me happy, that makes me happy, and so forth. And then we just perpetuate ourselves running around on the hedonic treadmill. So to even come to Dharma at all, any kind of authentic Dharma. And of course, there's authentic Buddha Dharma, there's authentic Hindu Dharma, where there's clear, truthful identification. What are some of the true causes of suffering? What are some of the true causes of happiness? We find these in all the great contemplative traditions of the world. And so that's what I refer to when I say encountering Dharma. And then there are lots of good Dharma teachings, just within Buddhism alone. There are many good teachers, Theravada, East Asian, Tibetan Buddhist, and so forth. Many, many good teachings that are going on. And so Dharma has brought us here to this 8-week congregation, gathering, and then we'll disperse in less than 4 weeks now and have the opportunity to draw from the well that we've been drinking from for these 8 weeks, enrich our lives, make them more meaningful, but really set out on a path. I mean, that to my mind is the most important thing, not just doing a bit of Dharma here and a bit of Dharma there, but actually set on a path. To my mind, that is just actually the most important thing. Not achieving shamatha in this lifetime, vipassana, bodhicitta in this lifetime, none of those, but actually finding a path, having a clear sense and a knowing this is the path, and then pursuing it. So whether one dies tomorrow or dies in 50 or 60, 70 years from now, that there is a path and there's a continuity that carries beyond, through this life and beyond this life. To try to place a value on that, and all this hinges on the hypothesis that consciousness just cannot be extinguished. just many things you can do with consciousness. Just the one thing you can't do is make it turn into nothing. Just like every other element of nature, space, time, matter, energy. You can do all kinds of things to space, time, and matter, energy, but you just can't turn them into nothing. And consciousness is just as natural and fundamental a phenomenon to nature as space, time, matter, energy. There's conservation principles all over nature, and consciousness is one of the, perhaps the most important one of them all. So in that context, this vast context, to establish a continuity, a path, really strikes me as of the highest importance. And then to know it. So often in my meetings with you one-on-one, I've emphasized a point that I really very strongly believe in, and that is for settling the mind in this natural state. Take an example. It's not enough to do it correctly. Not enough to do it correctly. While you're doing it correctly, you need to know that you're doing it correctly and have that confidence and come to again and again and see, oh, I'm not doing it correctly. And then recognize then that, come do it correctly again, and then have that confidence. And every time you're coming back and doing it correctly and knowing it, the confidence deepens. It deepens. It deepens. And likewise for all of the other practices, awareness of awareness, the four immeasurables. And so in a similar fashion, to have a life with all the opportunity to be able to set out on a path, simply having such a life is not enough. It's not enough. Having such opportunity and then knowing you had the opportunity, that's enough. Enough to really set out on the path. So I was reminded as I was meditating just before coming here of a passage that I think has had really a very profound and lingering effect on my life. Because I read it when I was in my teens, and I've never forgotten it. There are not many things that I've read at any time throughout my life that I've never forgotten. But this is one of them. And it's before, just about the time or before I encountered any Buddhist teachings at all that sunk in. But I thought it was so, I know it is so valuable to me that I decided to write it down verbatim. And I'll just send it to Kimberly so it can be on the notes for today. But this is from Henry David Thoreau. And it's from chapter 2 of his book, Walden, which is his account of his disengaging temporarily and really quite literally going into retreat, living in solitude, not absolute solitude, but pretty much solitude, a drastically simple way of life for about 2 years, about long enough to achieve shamatha, by Walden Pond up in Massachusetts. And he explained in his book his account of this experience of his. The title, chapter 2, is Where I Lived and What I Lived For. And he summarizes it in one paragraph that I find just immensely meaningful. It's been kind of a North Star for me ever since I read it. And here it is. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and to see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear. Nor did I wish to live to practice resignation, unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and so and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, and cut a broad swath and shave close to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. And if it proved to be mean, why then to get to the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world? Or if it were sublime, to know it by experience and be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion. My mind, that's just nectar for the mind. And it moves me today. Whenever I read it, I almost am moved in the same way. So, mudita, empathetic joy. For him to have that opportunity, he had to be in a situation where he didn't have to spend every moment of the day just trying to get by, just to get enough to eat, take care of his kids, get shelter, clothing, lodging. He had Ralph Emerson taking care of him. He had a benefactor to take care of him in his very meager needs when he was living by Walden. I believe he was taking care of him at that time, kind of a benefactor. So he found leisure and opportunity. leisure and opportunity. So here we have leisure and opportunity. Leisure, there's so few demands on our times, and opportunity. And the opportunity, this is where mudita really comes in, the opportunity subjectively. And that is just to come here and say, wow, this is a great place. Let's go to the gym. You know, well, that's one thing you could do here. A lot of people will do that and swim and frolic and have a lot of hedonic pleasure as much as they can, squeeze out. But we didn't come here for that primarily. Gym, certainly take good care of the body. There's the leisure, but then the opportunity in terms of your own motivation, your discipline, your aspiration, your ideals. Having a teacher that can guide you, that's helpful. And most importantly, the practices themselves. With that configuration, that constellation of inner and outer, there's simply no limit to the possibilities. No limit. To really know what is the meaning of life, to know the nature of life, and so that, how did he end it? It was so interesting, it's so utterly Buddhist, that last sentence. And if it were sublime, if it turns out, once you've recognized the genuine meanness of life, the mental afflictions and all the habits that flow out of craving, hostility, pretty mean, that's samsara. But it's not samsara up all the way up and all the way down. So he makes this comment that, I love the way he phrased it. I mean, the phrasing is just magical. Where he says earlier, nor did I wish to live to practice resignation unless it was quite necessary. So he's even willing to consider, maybe if human existence is such that just don't get your hopes up. Because you get hopes up, they will be squashed. You really don't have much potential at all. So resign yourself to that. You're just human. You're just hardwired. You're just an animal. And just get over it. Hedonic is all you can hope for. And if that's the way it really is, he's saying, okay, I will practice resignation. But only if it's quite necessary. Only if reality demonstrates unequivocally you've got no option. Right? But then to live deep, suck out the marrow of life, shave it down to the essential core so you're not distracted by anything. Reduce it to its lowest terms, its fundamental features of what is it to be a human being. And then as we are settling the mind in this natural state, a good example, if what we encounter is mean, then get to the meanness of it. See right through it, right? But if we can get beyond the meanness, which is there, habitual propensities, all of that, if we can penetrate through that to the sublime and not just simply believe it, but to know it by experience, as he says, and then to be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion, whatever that may be. So it really strikes home to me the importance of the path and the possibility of venturing onto a path and following that path. So some of us, not I for the short term, will have the opportunity upon leaving here to venture into a long-term retreat and maybe achieve shamatha and beyond that. Some of us, including myself for the time being, have commitments, meaningful commitments, that we'll gladly take on when we leave here. But to hold in mind, and I'm just offering this as a suggestion, to hold in mind that sooner or later when the time is ripe, and you'll know it's ripe, but holding it in mind is so important. Sooner or later, when the time is ripe, the outer and the inner circumstances have come together. To be able to, like Thoreau, take off not just 8 weeks, take off some extended period of time and just go for it, right down to the marrow, right down to the marrow, right down through all the layers of your mind and come down to that from which your mind springs forth, right down to the substrate consciousness, taking off a year or two, something like that, like Thoreau did, but I don't know that he had a shamatha teacher. I think of great value. And then beyond that, if one achieves shamatha, then why not? If all the outer circumstances, this is the thing about shamatha, you look for the outer circumstances, what are the inner circumstances, you put them together, and it's like baking a cake. You know, if the outer circumstances are there, the inner, then it's only a matter of time before the cake is baked. You know, there's just no intrinsic reason why it shouldn't happen when all the outer and inner circumstances are there. But from that platform, from that platform. I mean, it's like you've launched the Hubble telescope of your mind beyond all the atmospheric distortion of the Earth, and now you can see into deep space. From that perspective, you can see right over there, there's Mount Vipassana. Oh, there's Mount Bodhicitta. There's Mount Rigpa. There's Mount, and, you know, it's like, wow. Those are the peaks I could climb from here, you know. And so this is what I'm really getting to with the notion of path. That we don't just spend a life practicing Dharma, which is a wonderful thing, and many people do it. Practice a bit of this and a bit of that. A little bit of Rigpa, and then a bit of Shamatha, a bit of Bodhicitta, a bit of this and a bit of that. And, oh, I heard about a new teacher. Let's go see what he teaches. And all of that creates a nice soup, Dharma soup. I keep on coming back to the path, because the Buddha didn't go off to the jungle, off to the forest, to practice Dharma. He could have practiced Dharma at home. Come on, we can all practice Dharma at home. Right? He went off to find a path and to follow that path to its culmination. So to actually realize Shamatha. And if we just take it, if we strip the Mahayana teachings, and especially now focusing on the Dzogchen Avenue, just strip it down to its lowest terms, the most basic terms. Strip it bare. Lean. Lean and mean. But not really so mean. But just what is absolutely essential. It's Shamatha. It's Vipassana. It's realizing Rigpa, ultimate and relative bodhicitta. And then finishing it. Becoming awake. So it's in order to seek to inspire others to find a path, to follow it, offer as much guidance as I can, and to create environments for people to be able to devote themselves full-time to such an endeavor for sustained periods. That sums up in one sentence why I'm still active in the world. That's really it. I don't have any good reasons. There's a lot of good teachers, a lot of good retreat centers and so forth, Buddhist, non-Buddhist and so forth. But this is what keeps me out. And I'm happy to have such friends as Klaus, others as well, share the vision. So Klaus told me just recently, we had dinner together just several days ago, last week. And he said he's now getting quite firmly resolved. He'd like to create 40 rooms, just over there. 40 rooms for people who would like to go into a long-term retreat. And have the same food we're having now. And your own private room, $20 a day. And if you're 50 or over, you can all do it. The visa, you can get a retirement visa, no sweat. But we're also now working. I will be meeting with someone right at the day after this retreat ends to see if we can form some very meaningful liaisons with some, at least one Buddhist organization here in Thailand. And so that even if you're not 50, you can get long-term visas, because that's an enormous issue. To be in retreat and have to pop out every 3 months is really break the continuity. So we're going to do everything we can, Klaus and I. First of all, to create an environment here. If you're 50 or old, don't worry about it. Visa's set. If you're under 50, then we'll do all we can. Not only to create the environment, but also to try to provide visas. And then $20 a day, this food. I think I've sold you all. Just when I said this food, that made you want to come, right? And then your own private room. In the meantime, I'm working now very diligently to see if we can create, especially long-term, what I call a contemplative observatory right near Santa Barbara. We found some land that would be very, very suitable. And same thing, I'm thinking there, not as good food, but maybe $15 a day. Just your room, your food, marvelous environment, expansive views, very clean, very quiet, and just be able to hunker down and do your work. And once again, I'm really very, very strong commitment. I want to do everything I possibly can to make it possible for not only Americans and Canadians, but people from other countries also to come there and get visas. And I think we have a strategy. It'll take a while. This will take a while. But, you know, not decades, a couple of years, 2 or 3, 4 years, something like that. And then in the meantime, good friends in Mexico working on this similar vision. Friends in Brazil, definitely similar vision. There's one person has beautiful land in Tasmania. The land is already there. She doesn't have money to build, but she really would like to create an environment, not to build a retreat center to make money out of a retreat center, but to create an environment for long-term yogis to come. And I'm looking for the right partners in Europe, a number of potential partners there. to create one there as well. So, to take delight, this is where we'll end. I will end. We'll go back to the meditation. But to take delight in the momentum and the opportunities that have brought you here, to envision how your life may unfold, recognizing for yourself that the whole pursuit of and the realization of the actualization of hedonic well-being, once you've taken care of that, so important to take care of, is also you can find genuine happiness. That's really the meaning of life. I mean, I don't have any doubt about this. I have a number of convictions, and that's one of them. And to have that, as I said, holding in mind, there may be, in my case, I think very good reasons. I'm not going to change any of the commitments I made for the rest of this year or next year. They're good commitments, so I won't be able to go on a long-term retreat in the near future. But to hold in mind, if and only if, you think this is really something of core meaning, to orient one's life towards living as meaningful as possible now, not waiting, absolutely not waiting, but orienting and cultivating one's whole way of life so that when the time is ripe, be able to slip into, year or two, go off and achieve shamatha, and then proceed from there on the path. Strikes me as being of great value. Oh, not so? Let's practice empathetic joy. In the same spirit of empathetic joy, taking delight in your own opportunities. Take delight in the leisure we have right now. Knowing that our food is being prepared, all is taken care of around us in this environment. And take full advantage of this leisure and this opportunity. Settling your body, your speech, and your mind in the natural state so that they may become serviceable for engaging in truly meaningful endeavors. then as we venture into the meditative cultivation of empathetic joy, taking delight especially in genuine happiness and its causes, let's begin by taking stock, clearly recognizing the situation we have right now, not just here in Phuket, but overall where we are placed in our lives, and the opportunity that lies in the palm of the hand. Take delight in this whole realm of possibility that lies immediately before you. And let your attention rove back to your earliest memories of childhood. And as if you were settling the mind in its natural state for just a bit, focusing there on very early childhood, see what comes up. What memories come up, what people come up. Attend especially, not just on the appearances of the mind, but attend to the people who have nurtured you, loved you, cared for you, taught you, protected you. With each out-breath, breathe out the light of gratitude, joyful gratitude, taking delight in their virtue. Bearing in mind, in each case, we're always attending to the virtue. We're not trying to find perfect people who are always virtuous, difficult to find. We're taking delight in the virtue, wherever it occurs, in whomever it manifests. and at your own pace, let your awareness move forward through time. Recalling your own virtues and the virtues of those around you. And especially to those acts of kindness that have made it possible for you to be where you are here and now, facing an ocean of possibilities. And with each out-breath, take delight. Breathe out this light of joy, of gratitude, satisfaction. Let your awareness move through your youth to early adulthood. Or if you are still a young adult, move slowly. Gradually coming to the present. your awareness come to the present situation. The leisure, the opportunity that lies before you right now, in which you are immersed. And consider the possibilities. Taking delight in all of the efforts of those over the last few years, Klaus over many years, to make this financially possible. The many causes and conditions coming together. And take delight . Then let your awareness rove into the future. As you anticipate the leisure and opportunities that may lie in front of you, even in this life, imagine embracing those opportunities wholeheartedly to derive the greatest possible meaning for this life and all that may come. Release all appearances. Let your awareness rest in its own nature, holding its own ground, and linger for a little while after the chime sounds. Let's bring this session to a close. Hola, Sue. With no monologue, are there any questions, especially about the practice of awareness of awareness? Is it getting clear? Is it still nebulous? Elusive? Yes, Yin. Thank you, Lizzie.
Question. When we in the second stage, settled mind, in the nature state,
yes,
is the thought, it's always come.
Yes.
This is the substra consciousness. Is this substra consciousness or the space where the mind, where the thought come? And I cannot make a difference between this space and the awareness from the awareness. Mm-hmm. Is aware.
Okay.
Is here the aware, ripa or substra or something?
Or?
Ripa.
Or?
Or substra.
A substrate, yeah.
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 So it's my question.
Okay. Something became a little bit clearer just in terms of hierarchy and asymmetry when I was speaking with someone just today. And so I'll run through that, but it's directly to your question. I'm not going off on a tangent, okay? And that is when you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, the focus of mindfulness is sensations of the breath until the acquired sign comes up, right? But in order for that practice to be really effective, it's not enough just to cultivate mindfulness, right? There must be introspection. Those two always go hand in hand. Whether you're practicing vipassana, you're practicing shamatha, whatever you're doing. Mindfulness is focusing. But until you really have achieved shamatha, then you need introspection to monitor how it's going. So with introspection, even while the main force of your attention is on the breath, with introspection you are noting the thoughts, the images, the degree of excitation, laxity, and so forth that is arising in the mind. And if you're not noticing that, you're not practicing correctly, right? And so there's mindfulness of breathing. Now, when you move to settling the mind in its natural state, there's no need to be aware of the breath. In fact, it's you choose not to attend to the tactile sensations, to anything outside of the domain of the mind, right? You're selectively choosing that one domain and unselecting or deselecting five domains of the five physical senses. So now you're focusing your whole mindfulness on the space of the mind and whatever arises within it. At the same time, you're not doing the practice correctly unless you're monitoring the flow of your awareness. In other words, even as you're attending to the space of the mind and its contents, you are aware that you're aware, as you were earlier in the mindfulness of breathing. You're focusing on the breath, you're monitoring thoughts, images that come up, but you're also aware that you're practicing. There's an awareness of awareness that is implicit. It's got to be there, right? Even practicing mindfulness of breathing. But now, as if we've dropped off one stage, when you settle the mind into natural state, you drop off the stage of deliberate awareness of sensations of the breath. Now you're focusing on just, in a way, two out of the three that were present in mindfulness of breathing. There it was, sensations of the breath, your mind and your awareness of it. And now you drop off your awareness of the body, sensations of the breath, and while settling the mind in its natural state, your mindfulness, of course, focus on the space of the mind and its contents, introspection, monitoring the flow of awareness, and of course you are aware that you are settling your mind in its natural state, you're practicing, yeah, you're doing the practice. Now, where do those thoughts come from? They arise independent upon prior causes and conditions. So frequently when I've met three people in the morning, Then when I just start my meditation, especially if I just let my mind go free, then images of those people will come up. Why shouldn't they? I was just talking with them, you know. And so sometimes things linger. Or when I'm meditating just before the morning session or the afternoon session, I'll let my mind go to the future and just see what bubbles up. So if you're wondering, you know, where do I come up with all this stuff for the morning sessions, the afternoon session, I'm not reading anything. I'm just, it's whatever bubbles up, you know. And if I think it might be worthwhile, then I share it. And if I don't, then I'll just keep it to myself, right? And so the images and so forth will be catalyzed. Cooperative conditions are called. Or they'll be catalyzed by all kinds of things. People we meet, what we had for breakfast and so forth and so on. Where are they emerging, these thoughts and images? Now I'm coming to your question. Where are they emerging when we're settling the mind in a natural state? They're emerging in the dharma dhatu, the domain of phenomena, specifically mental phenomena. That's where they're arising, independent upon multiple causes and conditions, right? And so they're arising there. So one can say, well, they're emerging right out of the dharma dhatu, the space, the domain, the field of mental phenomena, right? But when it's persistent, you say, yeah, but where does that come from? Where does the, so like a little child that says, why? Yeah, but why? And why? You know, following that, we can similarly ask, well, yeah, but where does that come from, this dharma dhatu, this relative dharma dhatu, the space of the mind? Where does that come from? Come out of nothing? That it emerged out of a neuron? Come out of your nose? Where does it come from, right? And the Buddhist, the Dzogchen answer in particular here, because I've seen it more clearly here than anywhere else, this distinction between substrate consciousness and substrate, I haven't seen it anywhere else, and I find it enormously useful, right? The alaya and the alaya vijnana. So where this dharma dhatu, where is it coming from? It's coming from the substrate. But now it's configured as human, right? Because you're looking at it with human, coarse level of mental consciousness. So there's mental consciousness, which is human. In your case, it's a woman's mental consciousness, and it's conditioned by your personal history and so forth. And so, but where did your mental consciousness come from? Your, Yen's, mental consciousness, coarse mind. Where did that mental consciousness come from? Again, did it emerge out of your brain, out of nothing, out of space, from God? The Buddha gave it to you? Where did it come from? And the Buddhist answer, Dzogchen answer, your consciousness, your mental consciousness, is emerging from and got configured as it emerged from your substrate consciousness. And the substrate and the events, the phenomena, the appearances that arise there, where did that emerge from? That dharma dhatu, that domain of the mind, that emerged from the substrate, and the images, fundamentally, they're emerging, fundamentally, on a relative level, they're emerging from the substrate. But let's imagine you ask, yeah, but where did that come from? Where did your substrate consciousness come from? Where does that come from? Your substrate consciousness, yes, one can say, especially like when you fall asleep and you just completely blank out, you're not even aware that you're asleep, then your substrate consciousness, you can say, has kind of slipped into the substrate, right? So in one sense, and this comes up on occasion in Dzogchen traditions, the substrate consciousness emerges from the substrate. But of course, from lifetime to lifetime, now speaking the Dzogchen perspective, it's this substrate consciousness, also called subtle continuum mental consciousness, that carries on from lifetime to lifetime, out of which, as you were a fetus in your mother's womb, out of which then your mind emerged out of your continuum of substrate consciousness. So when you were born as a little baby, displaying a completely unique personality, I'm sure you're not like, if you have any siblings, I'm sure you're not just like your siblings, even though your genes are very similar, parents are the same, and so forth. But that specific configuration of infant's personality, what they like, what they don't like, whether they're happy, they're grumpy, or whatever they are, conditioned not only by genes, neurophysiology, conditioned heavily also by the substrate consciousness that carried on from past life. Because where did the substrate consciousness come from? At the deepest level. And there, not in a matter of causality, here's the cause and here's the effect. That's good within this domain of causality, within this domain of relative truth. But if we ask, well, yeah, but fundamentally, what it has emerged from, and the Dzogchen view is, your substrate consciousness emerges from Rigpa, but not in a conceptually graspable fashion. Because when we try to grasp it conceptually, then we're locked into time, we're locked into causality, this, then this, then this, and Rigpa is not within this matrix of causality, right? But in a manner of speaking, we would say substrate consciousness crystallizes from, cr- crystallizes from, rikpa, or pristine awareness, primordial consciousness, as the substrate crystallizes from Dharma Dhatu, the ultimate Dharma Dhatu, the absolute space of phenomena. Right? So now what is the difference? So I was doing a progression there from mindfulness of breathing to settling the mind, and then we go to awareness of awareness. And as the transition from mindfulness of breathing to settling the mind, something dropped off. And two things were kept. What was kept is you're still aware of the mind as you were in mindfulness of breathing. You're monitoring it with introspection. And you're aware of your own awareness. You have to be in mindfulness of breathing too. You have to be know that you're aware. But what drops off is deliberate awareness of sensations of the breath. And now similarly, as we transition from settling the mind to awareness of awareness, something drops off. And that is, there's no longer any interest. There's no longer any attention deliberately given to either the space of the mind or the thoughts, images, and so forth that arise in it. They were the primary object. But just as the primary object of mindfulness of breathing is dropped when you go into settling the mind, when you move from settling the mind to awareness of awareness, the primary object of mindfulness of settling the mind is dropped. No longer any interest in space of the mind or any contents of it. So what's left? In the first phase, there were three things: mindfulness of sensations of breath, awareness of the mind, awareness of awareness. All three are there. Second one, only two things remaining: awareness of the space of the mind and the contents, and awareness of awareness. And now we, as Thoreau said, I'm going to shave off everything non-essential. And so now we shave off, we release any interest or focus on either the space of the mind or its contents, and there's just one thing remaining, and that's awareness of awareness. So as soon as there's any directionality, as soon as you start thinking, oh, but I want to practice awareness of awareness. What should I be looking at? I've forgotten. What was the object? What was the object? It's the wrong question. It's a wrong question. There is no, I'm pointing my finger, there is no object to look for. It's pulling back. And I phrased it, what really caught me this morning and just kind of the words that flowed out, is you're now knowing what you already knew. And you're resting in the knowledge that you already held. And that right now, you're already aware that you're aware. You didn't suddenly become aware when I said, oh, are you aware or not? You already knew it, right? And that's what you know perhaps most intimately and most indubitably. That is that which cannot be doubted. And you just rest in that indubitable knowing of knowing. Is that any clearer? And what is? It's not working, so maybe you did.
There we go.
Yes, yeah. Right at your mouth is good.
Okay. My question is, this aware in the, is this rupa?
Okay.
Or substrate?
It's when you're just settling the mind as natural state.
In the third.
Oh, in the third, awareness of awareness.
Aware. What is
when you're simply,
aware?
when you just start practicing awareness of awareness, what is the nature of the awareness with which you are aware? And it is, among the five skandhas, it's consciousness. Among the six types of consciousness that are the standard list, the most common list in Theravada Buddhism and so forth, it's mental consciousness. It's mental consciousness. That is that with which you are aware. It's simply mental consciousness, which is arising independence upon a bunch of prior causing conditions, including brain physiology and so forth and so on, right? So that's what it is. Because it is configured. It is configured. I mean, you know, we just don't immediately drop the configuration of the mind. And so you are, with mental consciousness, you're aware of mental consciousness. And it's still on the level of coarse mind. So it's way up there at coarse mind level. But then slowly and patiently, if one persists in the practice, doing it correctly, then the configuration starts to melt away. And your mind, in this practice also, awareness of awareness, your flow of mental consciousness gradually melts or descends into its natural state. It becomes unconfigured. And as that happens, then it withdraws back into that from which it arose. And what it arose from is a substrate consciousness. Okay? So it's not other than the substrate consciousness. It's not like substrate consciousness over here and then and out here is some different kind of substance, different phenomenon altogether, is the mental consciousness. The mental consciousness is always a coarse manifestation of the substrate consciousness. And we release the coarseness so it dissolves back into the subtle, underlying, more primal continuum of substrate consciousness. Now, is that substrate consciousness the same as, or is it fundamentally different than, Rigpa? And the answer is neither one. It's not the same as. Otherwise, all you'd have to do is achieve shamatha, and you would achieve Dzogchen. Right? Well, that's not true. That's not true. So it's not the same as. But is it fundamentally different than? Well, that's not true either. Because the very nature, if you fathom the very nature of your substrate consciousness, you'll see that it's never been anything other than Rigpa. But it's veiled by veils upon veils of grasping. Veils of grasping. And that conceals grasping and reification, which is just one more form of grasping. That veils, obscures the nature of Rigpa. So this is what one has to break through in the tekchu, or the first major phase of bona fide Dzogchen practice, based upon the preliminaries, the shamatha, the vipassana. Then the next, then when you've really come to Dzogchen land, when you're climbing Mount Dzogchen, the first major phase of practice is tekchu, which is breaking through or cutting through. And what you're cutting through is the rigidity, the ossification, the hardening, the crystallization, the frozenness of your own substrate, which is individuated and locked in time. You're breaking through that, first with vipassana, and then with the tekchu. Vipassana to realize its empty nature, tekchu to break right through it, and then to fathom Rigpa itself. Okay?
In the Mahayana Buddhism, in the China, Chinese
yes.
Buddhism,
yes.
There are different school.
Yes.
The school insists from Buddha nature many. But there are also one school, they say,
yeah.
Buddha nature is only, how to say, hypothesis.
Hypothesis, yes.
Hypothesis, yeah.
Sure.
And I don't know how is the... They say Buddha nature is some kind of encourage the people to go the Buddha way.
Oh, it's something
yeah.
that encourages us
but
and inspires you to become
yeah.
awake, yes?
But ultimately,
yes.
It's emptiness.
That's
so
true, too.
So I think I'm not sure from this school, but... it's from Nagarjuna.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know how it's in Vajrayana.
Yeah. Of course,
I
don't...
Buddha nature mm-hmm. is not all the school accepted.
In all Mahayana schools it is. All Mahayana schools. Not in Theravada. Not in Vaibhashika. Not in Satrantika. But all my... I believe... Menga yusamade... Don't think so. I think in all Mahayana schools that I know of, Chittamatra, Madhyamaka, all stages of Vajrayana, Kriya Tantra, Yoga Tantra, and so forth and so on, they all accept Buddha nature. But now, how do they understand it? Do they all understand it in exactly the same way? No, that's why they're different schools. Because people approach it with different temperaments. So I mentioned earlier... that the great Tsongkhapa was truly one of the most brilliant scholars and contemplatives, bodhisattvas, monks in the whole history of Tibet, but his staggering intelligence, which is amazing, and a fantastic erudition. I think he very deliberately, this is from the Dalai Lama, not just my interpretation, but the Dalai Lama said of Tsongkhapa, and the Dalai Lama has been trained primarily in Tsongkhapa's own lineage, so he really knows what he's talking about. He's a great scholar of this Gelugpa tradition. He said Tsongkhapa was writing, setting forth the whole nature of the path, from the start to the end, including Vajrayana. Most of what he wrote was about Vajrayana in his 18 volumes. I have them all, Tsongkhapa. And he's writing, he's setting forth the path as if from the perspective of a sentient being who's not enlightened. Right? And so when he gets to the point of Vajrayana, about which he writes very extensively, thousands of pages, when he comes to Vajrayana, and for example, you take an empowerment, a Vajrayana empowerment initiation, let's say for Vajrasattva. Okay, very good one. All schools practice. Before you take the empowerment, you just think, oh, I'm a suffering sentient being and I've got a lot of negative karma and obscurations. I want to purify them. So therefore, I'm going to take Vajrasattva empowerment. I want to practice Vajrayana to purify my mind, my body, my mind, mental afflictions, obscurations. So I'm going to practice Vajrayana. And let's imagine you're really qualified. You find a qualified Vajrayana master. He gives you the empowerment, right? And now you're empowered. You've given the oral transmission, the teaching, the empowerment for Vajrasattva, and you start practicing. When you come to the conclusion of the session, then, having imagined that you've completely purified your body, speech, and mind, all obscurations, you've just finished your session, how do you end the session? I was taught this at one of the first meditations I was ever taught by my Tibetan Lama. At the end of the session, what do you think? See. And now I'm free of all obscurations, and my mind is non-dual from that of Vajrasattva, and I am Vajrasattva. What, you became Vajrasattva with one session? That was pretty easy. You know, that's very quick. So how can Tsongkhapa justify this? I mean, you're not Vajrasattva. You haven't even, you know, you did one session. You just did one session of Vajrasattva. You did 100 mantras, and you're totally pooped out at the end. And now you think you're Vajrasattva. And he said, this is very skillful means. You're not really Vajrasattva yet, but by adopting that attitude, this will propel you towards the full realization of the primordial purity of your mind. So it's skillful means. It's a very skillful thing to do. Because you're attending to, and I'm interpreting a little bit, but I don't think it's wild. In Madhyamaka, Tsongkhapa is a tremendous advocate of Nagarjuna's philosophy of middle way. The Mula Madhyamaka Karika, especially, but all the treatises. And in the middle way view, the Madhyamaka view, all phenomena are empty of inherent nature. All phenomena. Mind, body, space, time, matter. Time is empty of inherent nature. It's not intrinsically existent. Time does not absolutely flow. There's no absolute extension of time between you, Yen, today, and you, Yen, the person who will become a Buddha one day, in your continuum. The day that you become Samyak Sambuddha, fully enlightened Buddha. There's you now. I'm presuming you're not yet a Buddha. Otherwise, why would you come to study with me? You'd be really nuts. Okay. I'm just going to make a wild guess that you're not a Buddha. Or you are, you're really humoring me. And I think... laughing quietly as I mumble and ramble on and on and on. But let's imagine you're not a Buddha, but then imagine in some years, lifetimes, then you are a Buddha. The time span between you as a not Buddha and you as a Buddha has no inherent existence. Has no inherent existence whatsoever. It does not exist from its own side. It exists independent upon conceptual designation. So in a way, Tsongkhapa is inviting you to throw the fishing line, the hook of your mind to the future, to the Buddha you will become, and then reel that into the present and adopt the enlightenment that you will one day actually realize and invite this into the present so that the fruition becomes the path. The fruition becomes the path. Now that's characteristic of Vajrayana in all schools, right? So that's one way of viewing it. It's really smart. Well, it doesn't have to believe it. When I say it's smart, it doesn't mean that now everybody has to believe it. I don't mean that. From my impression, this is really smart. Now, the Dzogchen, now this is again right from the Dalai Lama. The Dzogchen view, people, and His Holiness specifically referred to Lonchen Rabjamba, one of the great, again, scholar contemplatives, I mean, pretty much almost without parallel in the whole Nyingma tradition. He also lays out the whole path from the preliminary practices, stage generation, completion, Tekchu Trukya, the whole path. Culminating in Buddhahood. He does the same thing. But he's writing from the Dzogchen perspective. So according to His Holiness, as a Nyingmapa, as a Dzogchenpa, as he's writing, he's setting out the whole path from the perspective of, if you were a Buddha, what would the path look like? So Tsongkhapa is setting out as, if you were a sentient being, what would the path look like? If you're identifying yourself as a sentient being, you're saying, okay, this is who I really am. I'm Yen. I'm Alan. I'm really not enlightened. In fact, there's no part of me that's enlightened. I looked. There's no part of me that is infinite compassion, the tremendous unlimited powers of a Buddha. I don't have any of those qualities, those limited perfections of qualities, of virtues, of a Buddha. I don't have any of them at all. I have a little bit of virtue, a little bit of virtue there. And then tons, gobs of mental afflictions and obscurations. That's all there is to me. But I'm not intrinsically limited. I'm not intrinsically obscured, afflicted, and so forth and so on. I just am for the time being, and it's all of me. But I do have the potential, since my mind is not intrinsically and absolutely defiled by mental afflictions and other obscurations. Since it's not, therefore, I have the potential to achieve enlightenment. I have the capacity to do so. That capacity is my Buddha nature, and I have a Buddha nature. Because that is my capacity. And it does inspire me to then venture out and really achieve that which I have not achieved. And that is all the qualities of Buddhahood. And that's what the path looks like from the perspective of a sentient being. Now, if you look at the same path from the perspective of a Buddha, your Buddha nature is not something you have. You don't have a Buddha nature. Like you have a microphone. Like you have two legs. You don't have a Buddha nature. You are a Buddha nature. And Buddha nature is not potential. It's who you actually are. It's already actual. It's real. It's timeless. It's timeless. If it's timeless, there's no time that you don't have it. No time that you aren't it, to put it more succinctly. There is no time when you are not a Buddha, because your Buddha nature is timeless. Rigpa is beyond time. So you can't get it later on if it's timeless. And it's who you really are. And that's what's real. But you are thinking that what you have is delusion. What you have are obscurations that veil your true nature, that veil your own Rigpa. That's what you have. But what you are, Buddha nature. And all you need to do is realize that which is already there. Therefore, from this perspective, I said I wouldn't give a monologue. I don't know how to give a short answer to this question. I have no idea. From this perspective, you set out on the path and you decide, I want to follow Lonchen Rachamba. I want to become Nyingmapa. It's much more intuitive. It just resonates with me more than the Galupa. Or maybe I want to do both, but for the time being, I'm really going Nyingma. And so you seek out some Nyingma Lama and say, you know, I suffer a lot. I got a lot of mental affliction, a lot of obscurations, but I really want to set out on this path. What shall I do? And he said, oh, purify your mind. Practice Vajrasattva. Good. How do I do that? Well, get an empowerment. So then you go, and now it's from a Nyingma Lama, and you get your empowerment. You start practicing Vajrasattva. And at the end of the Vajrasattva sadhana, you're not pretending as if you're a Buddha. You're actually embracing who you actually are. Not who you will be one day, but who you actually are right now. And in so doing, you're affirming who you really are and shucking off like dead skin everything you thought you were. Conventionally, relatively. Poor Yen with her mental afflictions, and she has this ability and that disability and these mental afflictions and those obscurations and this negative karma and that good karma. You just put it in the dumpster. You just wash it out. You just wash it out. And all that's left is you as a Buddha. And a Buddha who is now, fully, right now, just waiting to be realized. So two very different perspectives, and they're completely complementary. So that's just within Tibetan Buddhism, right? These are two, they're not the same view. One is a perspective from that of a sentient being. One is a perspective from that of a Buddha. But Dalai Lama is embracing both. And he incorporates both into his practice. And I'm his student. I'm one of his many, many students. And it's something I utterly embrace as well. So I have not studied extensively East Asian Buddhism, a little bit of Chinese Buddhism, not much. But I strongly suspect, among the many brilliant minds and profoundly intuitive minds over the many, many centuries of Chinese Buddhism, I think you're going to find nuances on those same themes. That on the one hand, some will say, you are Buddha. I know they say that. Some say, you are Buddha now. And others will probably give it more nuance and more subtly, like Tsongkhapa does. Okay? Yeah. So I think there was one here that just had to do with practice, a question. So let's see if I can get to that, if it's short. I think so. Okay, yeah, here's one. I mean, it's a bit theoretical, but it is right on the spot of the practice. And this relates to the practice of awareness of awareness. These questions arose. Is awareness equivalent to the skanda of consciousness? And so, no, it's not equivalent to the skanda of consciousness. There are five skandhas. The sixth one is consciousness. But if we take the standard, there are a list of six types of consciousness and eight. We're going to just stick with the six for the time being. The five physical and mental consciousness. That's the most dominant standard and widely accepted. And some add the extra two, the Klishtamana and the Alaya Vijnana. So that's the fifth skanda. It's consciousness, but it includes all the five sensory ones. They're there as well, so there are six. Therefore, the awareness is not equivalent, that is, when we're practicing awareness of awareness, in that particular mode, is that identical to the skanda consciousness? No, it's identical to mental consciousness. Okay? Mental consciousness. Is it essentially rikpa? Yeah, emphasis on essentially. That is, if you melt it, if you melt it down, then there's nothing to your mental consciousness, even there on the coarse level. And then, of course, on the substrate consciousness level, there is nothing to the substrate consciousness. It's kind of like there's nothing to ice except for water. There isn't anything in ice apart from water, right? And if we think of water, and Tibetans often do this, well, water in its natural state, and they just mean room temperature. Its non-frozen state is fluid. But when it freezes, there's nothing to an ice cube. There's not any aspect of it, not even one molecule of it, that is other than the melted water that froze, right? There is nothing to substrate consciousness except for the rikpa that froze. There's nothing to your mind apart from substrate consciousness that froze more solidly. Right? And so it's not the same and it's not different. Is it essentially rikpa? Yes. If so, do other phenomena manifest rikpa differently? Well, sure. Rikpa is a non-dual from the Dhammadhatu. They're primordially non-dual, this absolute space of phenomena. So analogous to, not the same as, substrate consciousness and substrate, or let's take all three, mental consciousness and the relative Dhammadhatu. Now we go more subtle, substrate consciousness and substrate. Now let's go very subtle, primordial consciousness, or rikpa, and the ultimate Dhammadhatu, non-dual. But at that level, that deepest level, they are primordially and absolutely not dual. They are not differentiable. Okay? Whereas on the coarse level, we do have the sense, oh, my mental consciousness is looking at those mental phenomena over there. So there's a quite a clear sense of duality. So do other phenomena manifest rikpa differently? Sure. Manifest in all different kinds of ways. Hitler's mind was none other than his rikpa. Heavily configured, distorted, contaminated by his mental afflictions. And Jesus' mind, if I can be so bold, was none other than his rikpa, without those obscurations, you know, without the configuration. Is that which concentrates equivalent to or associated with the skanda of volition? It's certainly associated with it. Sure, volition is a cetasika, a mental factor. And so it is, and there are multiple mental factors. There is, for example, there's volition, there is mindfulness, there's introspection. There are 51 or 52, depending on which list you want to choose. And these mental factors arise concomitantly, that is, together with and focusing on the same object as the primary consciousness, in this case, mental consciousness, which, let's say, in awareness of awareness, that mental consciousness is simply focused on or is resting in its own nature and apprehending the preceding moment of mental consciousness, but that which sustains it. Why do you sustain the awareness of awareness for 5 seconds at a time, and then 10 seconds at a time, and so forth? Volition. Volition does that, right? And at the beginning, it will be quite explicit, but as you go deeper and deeper and deeper into it, then it's more like riding a bike downhill, and that is, you start flowing in it, and you don't have to keep on pumping it up or pedaling to keep it going. Okay? So, that's two. Coming back to live people. This, I think, was written by a live person, but that was just... We have several more minutes. Any more special questions pertaining to the practice that we've done? I wanted to not ramble on too long. Yes, Suzanne.
Alan, mine is a much more practical question about awareness of awareness.
Yes.
And I felt this morning in the session that you guided, I actually made some progress with awareness of awareness. Mm-hmm. My problem is that I find it difficult to divorce the physical from what I'm doing. And
sure.
So with the release, I can feel my whole body releasing and relaxing,
yeah,
which is fine.
Sure.
But of course, when you're withdrawing, I can feel everything start to constrict, contract, and I don't actually know how to let that go while I'm actually doing awareness of awareness.
Right. Continue to monitor the body and continue to settle your body in its natural state, because that's what we're forgetting, you know? If someone is to tell me, Alan, concentrate right now on Suzanne's face, and now watch me, for the podcast people, I'm really furrowing my, everybody can tell I'm really concentrating. Beady eyes, furrowed brow. I'm going to clench my jaw now. Boy, I was really concentrating, wasn't I? I must have been really concentrated. But I brought so much junk with me. Because here also, I'm now going to concentrate on your awareness also. Or concentrate on your face. And then there was no junk. There was no junk. I think of it as something slender. And that is when I just totally relax my body, relax the face, relax the eyes, and I'll do it again. It's so easy. And breathing naturally. I'm giving you everything I can. That is, I was giving you my full attention, right? But there was no contraction. And so in the world, in modernity, and this is not just modernity's problem, overall, and cognitive scientists, psychologists, neuroscientists have been studying this for years now, overall, generally speaking, when people really concentrate, they arouse the attention, it's effortful, there's a contraction, and they do it for a sustained period of time, and they're exhausted. I talked about that right at the beginning of this retreat, jet fighter pilots, musicians, and so forth. And so we're bringing all the baggage, it's ego. It's ego, it's hope, it's fear, it's grasping, it's all that stuff. And that's what makes concentrating so exhausting. And gives migraine headaches, all kinds of, and who knows, heart failure, who knows what. And so in this practice, just leave all the baggage behind. When we say withdrawing, there's no withdrawal of the muscles. It's just a withdrawal of awareness. Same thing with mindfulness of breathing. Now I'm going to concentrate on my nostrils. You know, I brought too much baggage, you know. What are you, eyeballs, what are you doing? Get out of the way. Forehead, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? Forehead, get out of the way. Stop that. It's something slender. It's delicate. It's so subtle. It's just mental awareness focusing on the sensations. Then there's no headaches. There's no tightness. There's no pressure in the head. Because it's just mental awareness, like a little kitten. Like a little kitten walking down the hallway, barely touching the ground. A little kitten of your mental awareness catches, and with its little paw, touches the tip of your nose. So likewise, when you withdraw your awareness from all appearances, totally relaxed. You know how relaxed it is? It takes effort to extend. For me to look way over at you, like, oh, you know, my awareness has to extend itself. You kind of wanted to stay home like a rubber band that's, you know, just loose. But now I'm going to go and stretch the rubber band of my attention. Oh, yes. Yes, Suzanne, what can I do for you? And I've stretched my attention out to attend to you, right? But now I think you don't need me you don't need me to visually attend to you for right now. So watch what happens. That was a release, not a contraction. Like when you loose the rubber band, it's a release, not jamming the rubber band back in. So when you're coming back in, it actually is a release. I speak following the words of Padmasambhava. He says, arouse, focus, concentrate. It's quite true. But it still has that mood of release because you're releasing engagement with all appearances altogether and letting your awareness come to rest. So when you first do it in the initial phases, now this is true for all of shamatha, and then I think this will be it for tonight. In all of shamatha practice, again, it's two sides of the same coin. When you look at that winding road of the elephant and the monk and the rabbit and all of that business, the winding road to shamatha, right at the beginning, the blaze of effort is very large, big bonfire, suggesting that it does take some effort here to stabilize the mind. You can't just totally go relaxed and expect just, you know, just resting in the infirmary with sole emphasis on just relaxation. Never mind not losing clarity, just snooze your way to shamatha. Nicola would like to do that. I think maybe Alan would like that. But that doesn't work out. That just gives rise to lots of snoozing, right? And so even there, as we all know, it's got to be a balancing act, right? And so there needs to be some effort. And relative to the amount of effort you'll give on stage 5, relative to the amount of effort you give on stage 8, the amount of effort that you need at the beginning is very large, right? But so, on the one hand, it does take some effort. Now, focus on your breath. You keep on going away. Good. Apply some effort. Bring it back. Stabilize. Count the breaths. Do whatever's needed. Do it delicately, but it does take some effort. And then as the mind is running better, like an engine that's gradually getting tuned, then less effort will be needed to do the same thing. And less effort will be needed to make the mind even finer. And less effort will be needed to make the mind even finer yet. Right? And so likewise, when we're first setting out an awareness of awareness, concentrate, really do focus, do. Because the mind is so habitually drawn to looking outwards. Right? Massive form of, a massive tendency of sheer habit. What? And out comes the mind. And, oh, what am I thinking? Out. It's sheer habit. And so it takes some effort to release that habit and to draw the attention in. But as we get more accustomed to it, then the overall mood is not so much of yanking it in, but releasing that which is pulling it out. And so it's like, ah. And then you can actually relax as you're coming in, as well as relax when you just release out to no object. So not out to some object to strike as a target, right? Then once again, we're back to effort land, right? But releasing out with no object and then letting it come back like a yo-yo. Ah, and then it comes right back. You don't have to pull it back. You just, and it comes right back to your hand, right? And so something like that. The final point, something quite interesting. I don't know that it's universally true, but it could be. And it turns out to be true for some people. By the time you get to stage 7 or so, the practice is going really, really well. You probably can sit for 3 hours, maybe longer, and it's really good practice. There's a lot of bliss, a lot of clarity. The body feels quite good. You're over that great hump of stage 6 where a lot of nyam come up. It can be really, really throw you off quite easily. So stage 7 is a pretty sweet place to get to. And one might think, oh, now this can be a matter of weeks. I mean, mind is so good, you know, hardly any obstacles. Tiny, subtle excitation, subtle laxity. Only those two are left. How difficult could it be? And it feels good. I really enjoy it. You want to just do it for 12 hours a day, you know? See, oh, then it's just a matter of weeks. I'll call my mom and say, I'm coming home for Thanksgiving. And boy, do I have a surprise for you. I'm going to come back, Shama de boy, you know? You know? And what turns out to be the case is that everything I said is just true. But it turns out, in many cases, to take longer than one might have anticipated. You might think of 7, 8, 9. I mean, I can count 8, 9, and shamatha. It's very close. But actually, it is very pleasant. There's no question. It doesn't get worse. But it turns out that this final fine-tuning, it's really fine, of getting over the hump where even these subtle imbalances may arise. So they just don't arise. From 7 to 8. And then for 8 to 9, getting over the phase where you even need to exert any effort at all. That's really subtle, right? And now you're in stage 9, and now making that final transition until the energies just, they break through. And you break through. You break through the desire realm to the form realm. It turns out, surprisingly, if one just was thinking linearly that everything should be like a machine, it may take a while. And the analogy is very interesting. So often I think of the analogy of the mini-cosm and the macrocosm of shamatha and then the broad spectrum of the whole path to enlightenment. And when one studies the 5 paths and the 10 mummies, which I eventually did after I had some time in a retreat, then I went back to Switzerland and studied, practiced, taught, translated for 4 years. And then again, I was gone. Then I took off for 4 years. Back to retreat. But in any case, when one studies these 5 paths, and you become an Arya Bodhisattva, overall, speaking just classically now, it takes one countless eon, very long time, finite, long, from the time you enter the path until you become an Arya Bodhisattva and achieve the Mahayana path of seeing. Okay. You've not only achieved the path, you've achieved the Arya Marga, the Arya path of a Bodhisattva, Arya Bodhisattva path. It takes one countless year. You've achieved the first Bodhisattva Bhumi. And now there's a lot of purification to do, because you haven't completely purified even the Klesha Avarana, let alone more subtle obscurations. And so to go from the first Bhumi up to the 8th Bhumi, one countless year. So comparable amount of time. But you're a Buddha, you're an Arya Bodhisattva. I mean, you've got fantastic abilities. Your samadhi, your wisdom, your compassion, unbelievable. And it still takes one countless eon to go from stage one to stage eight. You achieve stage eight, and now you're on the pure bhumi. All of your mental afflictions are gone forever. No mental afflictions whatever. Only the most subtle obscuration. They're called jnaya avarana. Jnaya avarana. Only the most subtle obscuration. Shijipa. Shijipa. Nyomombidipa kanga bangsare. Any shijip matoyomare. You've achieved the karasa, takpesa, pure bhumi. You're on stage eight. Unbelievable, almost inconceivable. The abilities, the depth of compassion, the wisdom, the insights, the clairvoyance. I mean, just almost inconceivable. Your jaw drops. If you take it seriously, your just jaw drops. Like, wow. Eighth bhumi, incredible. To go from the eighth bhumi to Buddhahood takes one more countless eon. You think, ah, but I thought I was already there. 9, 10, and I'm finished. Ay, 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 another countless eon. Right? And that's because it's so subtle. The obscurations are so subtle. The power of the mind is massive, just inconceivably powerful. But the obscurations are inconceivably subtle, and therefore another countless eon. So, there's a long way and there's a not so long way. And that's what Vajrayana is for. And what Dzogchen is for. And this Tutgela, the second phase of Dzogchen, culminating. Tutgela means direct leaping over. Leaping over. And it is a skillful means, is what it really is. A skillful means for actually leaping over the bhumis. Instead of going one by one, 1, 2, 3, 4, it's kind of like jumping from one stone to another across a pond. You just leap over and come very quickly to the culmination. So that's the path. But we do need good environments. So Klaus will try to create one here. But we need environments for that. It's hard to do that without a conducive environment, spiritual friends. Well, not so. Dinner's getting cold. Enjoy your evening. I'll see you tomorrow.